Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast on a beautiful Friday. At least we're getting ready for the weekend. Today's podcast is brought to you by Plexiderm, and we are bringing back a very, very special guest, the former editor-in-chief of the Weekly Standard, our good friend Stephen Hayes. So good to have you back on the podcast, and good to have you back on this side of the Atlantic, Stephen.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. It's good to be back. It is good to be back. It's been good to get back to the U.S. and to get sort of reacclimated and send the kids back to school and see people I haven't seen for a long time. So good to be back. Good to be in the middle of it all again.
So you were in Spain for a year, year and a half. How long were you gone?
A year.
A year. So what's the weirdest thing about coming back?
I mean, this will sound strange because I've been, you know, being a reporter and covering politics and doing this for a couple decades now. But when you're removed from the day to day, it's impossible to understand the intensity of what's happening here in our world. And, you know, you come back and the ferocity of the arguments and the depths of the polarization are truly remarkable. And, you know, I was well aware of it. I was following sort of generally what was going on. I was reading up and following you guys, and you still just miss it. You can't really appreciate it until you're in the middle of it. And now I'm back in the middle of it in a big way.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a real challenge for historians to capture what it was actually like on a day-to-day basis. So one news cycle after another being hit with all of this and how fast it all moved. Now, I assume that people think that we're going to be spending time talking about Sharpiegate, but obviously anybody that actually knows this knows that we're going to spend the first few minutes talking about the beginning of the NFL season. Could it have been any better? I mean, the Green Bay Packers playing the Chicago Bears for the NFL opener. And of course, the Packers, as you knew they would, go down and they win. You know, it was an ugly game, but beating the Bears is always one of the sweetest things. And it just, that felt like the relief for me. It's like football is back. The Packers are beating the Bears. So what if the President of the United States is losing his mind over a Sharpie? Life is good.
Here's a big question to you. Would we have spend a minute or two talking about it if the Packers had lost? I think probably we wouldn't. I mean, maybe we would have lamented the thing. No, the best part about the game for me was seeing the Packers with a stout defense. We haven't had that in nearly a decade. And boy, if there's ever an exciting and invigorating 10-3 victory, that was it, because our defense was totally suffocating. And there's no doubt that some of that is owing to the fact that the offenses in the four-game NFL preseason this year really didn't play much. So I'm sure part of that is just a rusty offense. But I think the Packers defense may be better than people had assumed. And certainly the free agent pickups, the Packers, for people who don't follow it closely, haven't been very active in free agency for years throughout the entire Ted Thompson era when he was running the show. And the new GM was active. And if I recall correctly, the safety that we picked up from the Bears got an interception.
Yeah,
one of the outside linebackers got two sacks and the other got one sack. So it was a pretty good night for the Packers.
And it's been a very, very, very long time since the Packers have had that kind of a defense. We lived through the Dom Capers era. And now, by the way, I stuck with him for a very, very long time. Didn't join the Fire Dom Capers mob at all, but really, I think we got almost acclimated to having to have an offense that put up so many points because the defense was always going to let us down. But that's not the case anymore. So we can wallow in that for a moment. Okay, so as a normal human being, you were watching the Packer game. I'm also a quasi-normal human being, but I did watch, and the debate ended. I want to make it clear, the David French Saurabh Amari debate ended before the game began. So, but it was extraordinary. We have a fantastic piece of the Bulwark today by Andrew Egger about this. And again, for people catching up, Saurabh Amari is this. I don't know how do you even describe him. He's the leading spokesman of this new illiberal conservatism, which is that that it's you know that liberal democratic tolerance is so old and busted, we need to have some sort of a theocratic revolution where we seize the public square and enjoy the fruits, etc. And for some reason, he decided to attack David French, writer for the National Review, going after him, accusing him of being a symbol of this, David Frenchism. It was always a rather thin, questionable idea, but they had a debate last night. And to put it mildly, it did not go well at all for Sohrab Ahmari, including, and I just want to play for you, Stephen, this little bit at the end. It's about 2 minutes, and it really captures something where, you know, basically what Ahmari is saying is, you know, that, you know, I represent a more muscular, masculine, you know, more courageous style of conservatism than you cuckservatives like David French. And French is not having it at all. And there was this exchange.
Profoundly Trumpian move and a McConnell move to stick by him. I'm not sure a President Jeb would have taken the heat of Washington Post op-ed. I don't...
His dad stood by Clarence Thomas.
I don't think a President French would have done that.
Oh, that's total bullcrap. That is total. Hey, I tell you what. You talk to me about courage when you've walked with your boots on Iraqi sand in the middle of the surge. How dare you? How dare you?
I mean, I hate to say this, but you were a JAG, right? Were you a...
I was certainly not like.
I think we have to run this for one more minute.
I was certainly.
You asked me to moderate. Here I am.
I was certainly not like the armor officers that I served with who are outside the wire every day. I served with heroes. I served with people who did things that I can't even imagine. Some of those guys who are closer to me than brothers were killed, horribly wounded. I did my best to help them. I was outside the wire with them regularly. I'm incredibly proud of my service, but I know where it fits in the scheme of the surge and who did what. I'm not SEAL Team 6, but I am somebody who, when I was 37 years old, was morally convicted that I could not continue to support a war that I wasn't willing to fight in myself. And I went to my wife and my two children, and I said, I feel like I have to join the military.
Whoa. Okay, so the line about you were in JAG, and that was like a high lob for David French, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, wholly inappropriate thing to say, of course. It's where you go in a debate like this. It's where you go if you don't have a substantive response. It's where you go if you don't have a good case to make. You take a shot like that. And, you know, and I think the David French response was appropriately indignant. And there's so much to say about this debate. And on the one hand, it only interests sort of dorks like us. On the other hand, it's fascinating to find so many people think it's interesting. And I do actually think that there are broader and longer term implications of this particular moment on the right, where you see this sort of full and unapologetic embrace of illiberalism and harsh attacks on sort of classical small L liberalism right now. Full disclosure, I consider myself a Frenchist, if that's now a term. I'm strongly on the side of David French in these arguments. And I think that the chief problem that Sohrab faces is that he hasn't fully thought out the logical ends of what he's arguing.
And I think that was apparent last night.
Right. I mean, he seems to sort of argue himself into these cul-de-sacs and then look up and think, where am I and what am I doing here and how do I get out of this position? I mean, in Sohrab's defense, or let me offer a small defense of Sohrab, I would not want to debate David French on anything. And I think the fact that Sohrab chose to engage him on so many of the areas where David French is truly without parallel, was an unwise tactical decision beyond the broader substantive problems that I think Sorab's argument has.
Well, and I do think he kind of blundered into all of this, that this all began with him tweeting about the evil of local libraries allowing drag queens to teach children how to twerk or something like that. And the question was always, okay, well, you know, how is this David French's fault? And what is your solution for this? What alternative
yes,
vision
exactly.
are you presenting? And what was really extraordinary was how thin it was, because basically what it came down to is he just wants, you know, Senator Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz to hold a hearing on it in the U.S. Senate. Well, okay, that's – I mean, really? that's really – but, you know, part of this is the – I don't want to use the term dumbing down, but it is the intellectual vacuousness of some of the people trying to create a Trumpist post-conservative ideology, when really it is simply this cult of personality, or this sense that we're going to fight, you didn't fight hard enough, but there's really no substance to it.
Well, and the important thing, I mean, look, as somebody who is very sympathetic to the Tea Party and, you know, who considers myself, you know, pretty strong conservative, I wanted Republicans and conservatives to fight more. For a long time, that was one of my chief complaints about the way that establishment Republicans were conducting themselves in Washington. They didn't choose to engage on substance. They didn't make arguments in favor of the positions they were advancing. And they often chose the path of least resistance. So I buy the actual case mm-hmm. there. I buy the critique. The question is, then what? What do you do? And, you know, you've written about this mm-hmm. a bunch, but the "well, he fights" retort that you hear from so many Trump defenders only gets you so far. Fights for what? Fights to get us to what point? Mm-hmm. What are the outcomes here? What are the things we're trying to achieve? And I think you find so many Trump supporters who have a difficult time articulating that because there isn't one.
Yeah.
It's the fight itself that they revel in. And look, I like a good fight as much as anybody, but if it doesn't advance the cause of limited government, if it doesn't advance the cause of U.S. national security, there's a certain point at which the fight isn't that important. And I would argue there are many ways in which these fights, because of the petty nature of so many of the fights that occupy our time in our politics today, they're counterproductive. I mean, you're fighting for what? So what? You know, Trump isn't winning many of these fights, in my view. But even if he wins these fights, who cares? If he wins these fights and embarrasses the mainstream media over, you know, some fight that he's picked with the media, who cares? What does that do to address the growing entitlement crisis? What does that do to make us safer? What does that do to take on jihadists? How is that you know, helping us keep track of the Iranian regime? It's just the fights for fight's sake, and they don't actually take us anywhere.
Oh, okay. Well, this is a good segue then, since we are talking about an actual fight. The Trump administration looks like it's coming very, very close to some sort of a peace deal with the Taliban, and you understand, of course, the exhaustion of the country, of the endless war in Afghanistan, and the frustration that I think the electorate feels and that Trump is channeling. But it's certainly not clear that this deal they're cutting with the Taliban will be in the interest of either Afghanistan or making this country safer.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And there are two, I think, basic critiques to make of the way that the Trump administration is handling it. One is on the substance. One is on the substance of the deal. We don't know exactly what's in the deal. In fact, the president's national security advisor, John Bolton, doesn't know exactly what's in the deal because he hasn't been allowed to actually see it in person himself.
By the way, that in itself, a level of dysfunction that's mind-blowing, that they wouldn't actually let the national security advisor hold and get a copy of what they're negotiating. Is that right?
Right, exactly. I mean, that those were the reports. I think the reports are accurate. I heard the same thing independently. And it suggests a high level of dysfunction inside the Trump administration as they try to make policy on this important issue. I think it would be a grave error to withdraw completely. I think it would be a grave error to engage in the kind of peace deal that the Trump administration seems, by all accounts, to want. And if you look at the kinds of compromises that the reporting suggests this deal will include, it's worse than what the Obama administration was doing. I mean, ultimately, the Obama administration pursued this sort of ridiculous peace deal with the Taliban for years, and then ultimately didn't do it, didn't follow through, in part because the Taliban continued to move the goalposts, or, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use. It was never consummated. It was never finalized. You see the Trump administration now making the same kinds of compromises, and that is, I think, bad enough on itself. And the deal that's likely to emerge from those negotiations, I think, would be a bad one. The second critique, and I think in some ways it's more damning, is that they're whitewashing the Taliban in order to get this deal. And even if you believe that it's really important to do number one, you don't have to do number two. You don't have to pretend that the Taliban isn't a terrorist threat. You don't have to pretend that the Taliban is somehow neutral on Al-Qaeda. You don't have to pretend that the Taliban hasn't been supporting and doesn't continue to support Al-Qaeda, isn't inextricably linked with Al-Qaeda. But increasingly, that's what we're seeing and hearing from Trump administration officials. You had Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and you and I have talked about him many times before. I've long been an admirer of Pompeo. I think he sees things in a very clear-eyed way on a lot of these national security questions. But the other day, he said that both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are a shadow of their former self. While it's true that they've been degraded over the years, the Taliban is in a position of strength right now in Afghanistan. And the sanctuary it's providing for Al-Qaeda is undisputed. Nobody denies this. And the threats, I think, that we see are obvious. They're obvious every day in Afghanistan. We had a U.S. service member killed literally yesterday. But they're also the threats beyond Afghanistan, I think, are manifest as well, and will grow the moment we leave.
The news today is the Taliban captured the acting head of this provincial office of the Independent Human Rights Commission, and then apparently reportedly executed him. So it is interesting that you're getting sort of a sense of that the Taliban certainly have not changed their nature and have not really backed off on their violence in Afghanistan. And
they aren't, and we haven't demanded that they do so. I mean, I think that's one of the most remarkable things. You know, the Taliban put out a video 2 months ago rationalizing, justifying the Al-Qaeda attacks on 9/11, basically taunting the United States about the 9/11 attacks. This is the same. This is through official Taliban propaganda channels. At the same time that we are supposedly negotiating peace, they're poking us in the eye. They're committing these attacks throughout Afghanistan on the Afghan government that we recognize and is supposed to be our ally, as well as on U.S. interests and personnel. And we're so desperate for a deal, we don't let that speak to what the nature of the Taliban really is. And I think we will regret this deal for a long time if we, in fact, reach one with them.
But is there really an alternative? It's 2019 right now. We've been there now for 18 years. It does feel endless. Is there really a better option, or is it just time to say, "Oh, just screw it"? We can't be here there forever.
Yeah, we need to learn that lesson, though. We thought the same thing back in the late 1990s. We said, "It's not really worth paying attention to Afghanistan." You know that yes, there are some terrorists here. Yes, and we've seen what can result from that. And look, that's not inevitable, but it certainly makes it a lot more likely when we do neglect these areas that turn out to be hotbeds for groups, for jihadists, for individuals who hate the United States and want to harm us.
Okay, let's shift gears, and I want to talk about politics and some of the things that are going on. I'm certainly not going to let a podcast pass without dunking on Sharpiegate again. But let's do that in a couple of minutes, because I want to hear from our sponsor at Plexiderm.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to triplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's triplexiderm.com.
Okay, we're back with Stephen Hayes, the former editor-in-chief of the Weekly Standard, and actually the reason that I'm doing a podcast. I'm actually doing a daily podcast because of you, Stephen. You got me into this.
Do you forgive me for that? No, you're doing a great job. It's fun to listen to.
And you came up with the slogan for the early Daily Standard podcast, which I still think is good, which is smart, conservative, and non-tribal, and we continue to have that as the mission. Although I think when you and I first talked about this, you were saying, yeah, just the podcast like 10-15 minutes. You know, like these things kind of morph; they just keep growing. Yeah. Like 40, 50. Yeah. I think I blame
There's
Jonah Gold.
There's a lot Gold. To talk about, right? It has to grow.
And also people, use podcasts in different ways. And, I was really surprised when we first started doing the podcast that one of the complaints I got was they weren't long enough because people wanted to take their dogs for a walk or wanted to go on a commute and they wanted them longer. And then there are people, of course, like our mutual friend Jonah Goldberg, who goes on for about, 3 hours. I mean, he's like the Fidel Castro of podcasts, or sort of at the other end, but
I will tell him you said so.
No, he actually listens quite a bit. So yes. Let's just talk about where we have to talk about the Sharpie Gate thing. And I guess we are at the point, and I agree with Andrew Egger that we're at the point now where parody has been killed and punditry has been beaten to death. Because what more can you say about a president of the United States who just uses a Sharpie to rewrite a weather map to correct a mistake that, frankly, if he would have just let it go, nobody would remember it at all. And yet we are right as you and I are speaking now, I think we're in day 6 of him doing it. And I don't know if you saw this, but the Trump campaign is now marketing Sharpies. They've decided that instead of this being a huge embarrassment, a sign of the president's, absolute insane mendacity, clownishness, that they're going to turn it into something positive. So I don't know. You have a hot take on the Sharpie thing?
I mean, I don't know if it's a hot take. I think the Andrew Egger piece on it was very, very well done. What we have learned since that piece was published, courtesy of the Washington Post, is that it was the president himself who apparently made that extension of the path of the tornado so that it would include Alabama. Yeah, I mean, look, this is on one hand, it's frivolous and it's silly and it's what we've grown accustomed to over the past 3-4 years. So the temptation is not to pay it too much heed because it's just more of what we've seen. On the other hand, I forget who mentioned this on Twitter. I'm trying to get back on Twitter after taking time away. Somebody said, if you saw this in a friend or a family member, you'd be concerned. And I think that's right. I mean, this is not, as we've remarked many times before, this is not normal behavior. I mean, somebody doesn't do that. And you can see how it has unfolded, within sort of the White House and within the Trump world. The president goes out and says something, it's wrong. You have an official government agency in this case, correct it. The president then doubles down, triples down, and sends his supporters scurrying to find anything at all that could possibly rationalize what or justify what he had said in the first place. And then they use that they're taking, paths for the hurricane that were, something that was spit out among thousands and thousands of possible paths at the earliest stages of the hurricanes and holding them up and saying, see, it was going to hit Alabama. It's a problem. And it's the way, unfortunately, too many of these things have unfolded.
Yeah. And that of course is the challenge. How do you basically stop and say, okay, this matters, this is important, versus just being absolutely numbed by it and the past and the and the speed of the outrages. I mean, it comes to Friday. Friday is always very challenging because you realize all the things that have happened in the past week that are already old news that you've completely forgotten about. Okay, so here's a breaking news story this morning. I think it was in Politico. That at least four states, the Republican Party, which has become completely Trumpian, has decided to eliminate their primaries, not have primaries or caucuses, because they don't want to give any oxygen whatsoever to anyone who might want to challenge the president. I don't know. My first reaction to that was not a real confident move, but a very Trumpian move.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a power move for the sake of making a power move. You know, I read your piece on the Joe Walsh candidacy the other day. I agree with what you wrote. I agree with your assessment of him as a candidate. You look at the other candidates and prospective candidates, Bill Weld, Mark Sanford. These are not exactly great threats to Donald Trump and to the possibility that he'll be the Republican nominee again. I think the fact that you have state parties and other Republicans looking to do everything they can to quash any dissent, as you say, suggests a party that's not terribly confident in the president's position. I think, though, you're right to cast this as evidence of the further Trumpicization of the Republican Party. And we're seeing it on the presidential level, to be sure. We're also seeing it in a way that I think has been overlooked, but will be important on the congressional level with these retirements, because you're seeing, in some cases, long serving conservatives retire from the House of Representatives. And we've had a spate of retirements in recent days. Not old school establishment, you know, K Street pleasing Republicans necessarily, but conservatives, movement conservatives, leaving the House of Representatives and setting up in safe red districts and setting up situations where the likeliest outcome from the 2020 congressional elections is that the Republicans continue to win these seats in safe Republican districts, but they will be sort of Trumpian Republicans replacing, in some cases, more movement-style conservatives.
Well, that's the case here in Wisconsin, where Jim Sensenbrenner, who's been in Congress since 1979, retired. He was willing to push back against Trump. He was one of the 13 members of the House to vote against the emergency order.
Right.
And it is almost certain that he's going to be replaced by somebody who's going to be much more Trump-friendly. There's no question about that. I mean, it's not a guarantee, but it seems likely. So this all raises the question. I mean, moving past the whole Joe Walsh temptation and everything, which I understand the logic behind the Joe Walsh candidacy, and you know it is sort of the game playing that we've gotten into. But there is something about, you know, moving past Donald Trump, there will be a post-Trump Republican Party. There will be a post-Trump conservative movement at some point. And I do think that it's also important sort of not to lose our mind in the opposition, not to basically say, you know, everything but the crazy. Yeah, we're willing to overlook this racism. We're willing to make this bargain with this person because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. As you and I know, Stephen, this is one of the things that got us here. I mean, we spent years doing that sort of thing. And if we've learned anything from that, it's that there are some bargains that you probably shouldn't make, even if they make short-term tactical sense.
Right. I think that's right. And you know, some of our Trump skeptical friends have gone pretty strongly in the other direction, where they've taken the conservative arguments that they've made over the years and have just sort of cast them aside and are now making arguments that, you know, help them align very well with the left, not as a marriage of convenience or a temporary sort of alliance, but because they've actually changed their mind on all this stuff, it seems. I mean, that's certainly not me. I mean, I believe for the most part the things that I believed 20 years ago, the things that I believed 10 years ago, I believe them today. I assume I will believe mostly the same things in 10 years. And 20 years, not the same things on it necessarily on an individual policy basis, and not that we shouldn't, you know, be constantly reexamining our assumptions and testing them and growing and you hate to use the word evolving because of its negative connotations, but rethinking our positions. You shouldn't be so firm in your position that you're unwilling to reexamine them in the face of evidence. But the basic principles, you know, I still believe in pretty severely limited government at the federal level and elsewhere. I believe strongly in federalism. I believe in a strong national U.S. security posture. All of these things are things that I've believed for a long time that haven't changed. And we have seen a number of people who have been friends and colleagues of ours go pretty strongly in the other direction, just embrace big government liberalism because they don't like Trump.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, it does seem to be parallel. I mean, going to somebody like Joe Walsh, who, frankly, we would never have allied with pre-Donald Trump. And on the one hand, kind of counterbalance from the folks, including, you know, guests that I've had on this podcast, who are like, you know, if it's Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, I'm going with Bernie Sanders. I'm going to vote for an overt socialist who, very openly says that he's going to dismantle everything that I've claimed to be for, just watch. I don't know how much you watched. I watched just only some clips of the CNN town hall meetings on the environment, which really reminded me why I am not a progressive. And this is the lonely position that we're in right now, is that Trumpism is unacceptable, but the alternative is also is also out there. I mean, I'm not going to align myself with a party that thinks that hamburgers are a threat to the.
Yeah, we can't have a burger. And is there any form of energy other than solar and wind that will be acceptable in the future that the Democrats who participated in that forum laid out for us? I mean, it is dramatic and extreme, the kinds of things that these Democrats are arguing. And, you know, you look at the Democratic Party, and I think it was inevitable that throughout this process, the party was going to be shifting further and further left. We've had political science, we've had studies, we've had academic examinations of the move of the Republican Party to the ideological right. You haven't had as many of the same kinds of examinations of the Democratic Party moving left, despite the fact that that's happened. I think we're seeing it happen in real time, even more dramatically right now. I mean, some of the things that you have the ostensible moderates in the Democratic Party embracing to curry favor with the base of the Democratic Party, I think, are extraordinarily extreme. And frankly, they make Trump's path to reelection much easier, right? I mean, he's framed this as, you know, socialists versus Trump. And while some of the Democrats haven't gone full Bernie, they're inching their way over there in a way that seems to make Trump's framing of it more accurate.
Well, you know, and I mean, I understand their passion on climate change. However, I also know how it's going to play out in a general election in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, where their policies, the Green New Deal, will be characterized as massive tax increases that will result in massive job losses. I mean, that is the playbook. And they're walking into that in a way that I'm not sure that they anticipate inside their own bubble. And I think this is where we've seen how bubbles can be very, very self-destructive.
Yeah. I mean, just think of the potential ads that came out of that one event. I mean, you literally have them talking about red meat as the culprit here. I mean, people might care a lot about the environment. People might be willing to make compromises to address climate change. I'm talking about voters here. You're gonna run into some trouble if you start telling people they shouldn't be having their burgers.
Well, you know, you mentioned this polarization, and I never thought that Howard Schultz was going anywhere, but I find myself being somewhat disappointed. You know, and again, not surprised that he's pulling out. I don't think we needed another billionaire, but at least there was the prospect of somebody who did not want to vote for Donald Trump, wouldn't vote for an extreme liberal. And I thought the value of his candidacy was at least, you know, putting up a cautionary note to Democrats. Don't go too far left. Don't go too crazy. Otherwise, I'm going to give people a centrist, independent alternative. And now that's been removed. So if there's not room for a third way in this particular political environment, will we ever see a third party, or are we really just trapped into this binary world for the rest of time?
Yeah, it's a good question. One would have thought that either the 2016 election, which pitted Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump, or the 2020 election might have seen the rise of a third party, if ever there was going to be one. I mean, I'm not willing to say that we're never going to see one, despite the fact that the system, as it was built, as it's structured, heavily favors a two-party outcome. But look, we're looking at really unprecedented, probably not unprecedented, but pretty significant volatility in our politics over the past two decades. And if you look back and you look at the number of times that Congress has changed hands or houses of Congress have changed hands since 2006, we'll go back to 1994, wherever you want to start it, we've seen tremendous volatility in congressional control relative to the 50 years that preceded it. And we've seen these change elections one after another after another. I mean, really start with 2006. And you and I may have talked about this before, but the change in the House in 2006, and then you had President Obama winning on change in 2008. You had Republicans winning back in the Tea Party year of 2010. 2012 was sort of the exception that proves the rule. 2014, Republicans take the Senate back. 2016 is the election of Donald Trump and you know, a message from the electorate that if you thought we were kidding about change, this tells you how much we meant it. And then in 2018, we saw more change with people flocking back to Democrats. That is volatility that we haven't seen in our politics. And if it continues, you can see, despite the structures that seem to benefit a two-party system, you can see where those would erode or become more anachronistic over time.
Yeah, it is whiplash. All right, so I need to get an update from you. You and Jonah Goldberg have been working on your media project, and it has been eagerly awaited. Can you give us some sense of where you're at, what you're hoping to do?
Yeah, we're working hard on it. We're still sort of in the final stages of trying to raise some money for it, and we are pushing toward a launch in the coming months. We don't have an exact launch date, but we're pretty excited about building something new and making sure that it has the editorial values that we both share and our third co-founder Toby Stock shares. And we think there's an important voice. So it's almost like you can't have too many voices at this particular moment on our politics, particularly on the center right. So we're excited to get going. I'm sort of working on it an incredible amount of time, even though nobody's seeing anything. But it's really fun to put together.
So what's your mission statement? If you had to come up with a one sentence, which I'm sure you have had to do, how do you describe what you're doing that is different from, say, you know, the Washington Examiner, the National Review, Free Beacon, the Bulwark, Daily Caller? What is your niche?
Yeah, I think part of it is the way that we're going to share information. But you know, we're pretty determined to double and triple down on reporting. You know, there are plenty of places that do good reporting on the center right, and Eliana Johnson was just taken from Politico to become the editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon. And I was very encouraged to see in her comments about what she wants to do. She says she wants to build up reporting, train reporters on the center right. I think that's absolutely essential. And she's a fantastic reporter in her own right. So I want to see more of that. So what we want to do is create a place where we do a lot of that reporting, as much of it as we possibly can. If you're a conservative, as I am and as you are, I think you look at the media landscape and you look at the institutions on the center left, start in the center and move to the left. And if you ask the people who lead those institutions, what do? Almost every answer you get will include reporting, whether or not it's true. And whether or not we like the kind of reporting that they do, virtually all of the media institutions on the center left say that they're doing some kind of reporting. If you ask the same question to the media institutions on the center right, I think you'll get very few of them that say that, that part of their core mission is doing reporting. And I think that's a problem. As somebody who, you know, gave his first speech on media bias in 1988 at the Wisconsin State Forensics Championships, I think that, that there's a huge imbalance in the way that the media cover our politics today. And it's as pronounced today as it ever has been. And it's important that I think conservatives don't just sit back and take shots at the New York Times because this piece is biased or they didn't ask this question. Even if those things are true, it's really important to help frame the issues, to be at the press conferences, asking the one question that's different than the 20 that have preceded it, because you bring different experiences and have a different way of looking at the world. And if we succeed in this new venture in 5 years or in 10 years, we'll have a lot of people asking those questions, and we'll have a lot of people bringing different assumptions to the issues of the day. And we'll play a small role, I hope, in helping to frame these really important debates at this absolutely crucial time.
And this is crucial on the center, right? And as you pointed out, and I think we would have the same story about Eliana Johnson going to the Free Beacon, made the point that so far there, you know, despite some of the rhetoric about it, that, that there has been a shortage of this kind of fact-based journalism on the right, and for the right, so we, it doesn't descend into this alternative reality silo, this post-truth political tribal environment. We really do need this sort of thing to be able to go and ask questions, to be able to do the kind of investigative reporting, to do the kind of analytical reporting, the fact-based reporting on issues that would be interesting to people, you know, who are, you know, open-minded from a conservative point of view. And so this is one of the points that I think needs to be really stressed over and over and over again, that much of media bias isn't just, you know, snarky hot takes. It's what questions do you ask? What
exactly
do you investigate? What are you writing about? Because obviously the editors of the New York Times are sitting around thinking, you know, we need to have a major project in the depths of racism in America. Well, a group of conservative journalists might be asking a different question about, for example, the cost of regulations or the loss of opportunity because of certain government policies, or questioning the official version of events. And so it's not contradictory. I'm agreeing with you here. Not contradictory to say you have a point of view, but also that fundamentally you're practicing fact-based journalism with that ethos.
Yeah, and in many ways, I mean, there's so many things to react to in what you just said there. In many ways, I think it's far more authentic to have the point of view and to announce it to people. I mean, I'm a conservative. I've been a conservative for years. Jonah's a conservative. Our the company that we're building will be informed by our worldview, and we're going to be upfront and honest about it. I'd like to think that, you know, we certainly want to check our evidence. We want to report facts. This will be a fact-driven undertaking. We're going to do a lot of the reporting. We're going to put in the time. I mean, I think one of the reasons you've seen so many institutions set aside reporting or move on from reporting is it's resource intensive. It costs
expensive.
A lot
it's
of money.
It's expensive, yeah.
It's much easier to sit at a keyboard and fire off a 30-minute hot take than it is to go and spend the time on Capitol Hill, cultivating sources, checking with them about what's happening, reporting what's happening, and then putting it into a piece that's double and triple checked, and then fact checked on top of that. That takes a ton of time. It takes a ton of effort. So, you know, I think one of the things that we're going to do is to slow down the process. It's okay not to have a story about what Donald Trump tweeted about Chuck Schumer's comment about Matt Gaetz's, you know, interview on Fox News. Like, not everybody has to write about that. And I think it'll be a good thing to take time to go back and to report the stuff that needs reporting, to really spend time talking about the things that are in the news. And then, as important in many ways, find the things that aren't in the news that ought to be in the news and report the heck out of those too. So we are starting with very humble origins here. We're not like I think some of the other digital media companies that have launched over the past several years. We're not making promises that we're going to change the way people consume information. We're not making promises that we're going to take over the internet or any of this stuff. We're going to do what we think we do well at a very small scale at the beginning. We certainly hope to grow smartly and methodically and grow into something that has a pretty big presence. But we're going to start small. We're going to start slow. And we want to make sure that the stuff that we do is good and meets the standards that we have.
Well, we can't wait to see what you and your colleagues are going to roll out. Stephen Hayes, again, it is so good to talk with you. It's good to talk with you without having to have a transatlantic connection. Although that was actually pretty cool. I think you did a podcast with us when you were in Spain, or maybe a couple of them. Amazing, but you were probably, I don't know, you were probably sitting out with a Mai Tai or something during that.
A glass of Spanish red wine. Well, we're overdue on a beer, so next time you're out in Washington or next time I'm back in Milwaukee, we'll have to make good on that.
It is a deal. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.